Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. August 8th, 2008 already. Good grief, I've been doing the show 3 years on the 2nd. Past the 2nd, 6 days ago. Tonight we have an amazing guest, Dr. Robert R. Hieronymus, Ph.D. He has met with many, many dignitaries in his speeches, with Anwar el-Sadat, Gerald Ford. And my favorite thing is he's been featured repeatedly on the History Channel, which I watch all the time, the Discovery Channel, which is really cool, and the National Geographic Channels regarding his 2006 book, Founding Fathers, Secret Societies. His popular radio program, 21st Century Radio, has been broadcasting new Peridium topics across the United States for over 20 years. I want to introduce him. Robert, by the way, in case you didn't know, Ethan Allen was like my triple great-grandfather.
Congratulations. My heavens. Whoa.
And the guy that fired the shot heard around the world was Colonel Parker, as you know.
Yeah.
And after Ethan Allen had been asked the question by Colonel Parker, when does the war start? And Ethan Allen had said, God damn it, until somebody dies. And strangely enough, Wes Parker, long-term downtrend great series of great grandson, who won the World Series in 1972, he and I had a ionizer company back in the 80s with Dr. Donsbach, and we called it the Revolutionaire because nobody else knew what negative ionization and air purification systems were all about in those days.
Well, you're well ahead of your time. That's extremely important, that particular work. As a matter of fact, it's too bad that alternative health care hasn't been focused on more clearly in the last 30-40 years, because it certainly is making its way now, but my heavens, it's taken such a long time.
Well, I know the Hieronymus name is spelled in different, genders, but I guess you're somehow related to some of the other famous Hieronymus folks.
But I'm related legally.
Right.
I'm not related blood.
Okay.
I was adopted into the Hieronymus family by my stepfather, Robert Frederick Hieronymus, and I really didn't like the name at first for many years, because you don't like kids calling you Hippopotamus, Anonymous, and all that kind of stuff.
I was a bell, ding dong, and all those in mine,
You know how it feels.
That probably would fit today.
It's a strange feeling, isn't it? I mean, but the one person that I've had most admired within my family was an individual by the name of Thomas Galen Hieronymus. And his
exactly. Yeah,
and
I know who he is.
Fortunately, he had to work with Abrams and the Black Box and so many other things. And certainly, his work was totally misunderstood by traditional science because what he was working with were energies that, to them, didn't exist. But indeed, they did.
Today's field of quantum entanglement, we start to understand what he was really all about.
That's correct. That's right. He was really involved deeply in that. And what a person, too. The times we had showing me all of his some people called them machines, and they really weren't. There were various types of what he would refer to as tools that he used to enter and work through the etheric world. In the etheric planes, when, of course, most people thought that was impossible to do and didn't exist anyway. But he was an extraordinary soul and very much loved this nation. As a matter of fact, he and I spent a lot of time talking about the pyramid and the Ionia Triangle, which was one of his favorite symbols, by the way, and puzzling over so many different interpretations of that, which I began my work in that area in about 1965, when I saw this pyramid in the Ionia Triangle on the back of the $1 bill. Being an artist, it was the last dollar bill I had, and I
that's pretty good. I've been there before.
I bet you have.
Yeah.
The thing is I saw this symbol, and I thought to myself, this doesn't look American to me. And it was the first time I really focused on it, because I was thinking about what can you get for a dollar to eat for the rest of the week. In those days, you could get a loaf of bread and a pound of bologna. You could eat the entire week on that. It was terrible food, but it kept the acid out of your stomach, and if you could drink enough water and coffee, you were all right for a while. didn't want to relive any of those days. But looking at that eye in the triangle, I immediately tried to contact the State Department. And back in that time period, they sent me, what I wanted to know was, what did this symbol mean, eye in a triangle in the pyramid? And they sent me information on the front side, the eagle side, which is found on all the military buttons and everything. But they didn't say one word about the reverse of the Great Seal. And about 3 months later, after I hammered away at them, they sent me an actual photo, a black and white photo of the eye in a triangle, the pyramid, but it didn't have any information on it at all. I was really quite surprised, because obviously I thought that they knew everything about American symbolism, but at that particular time in the mid-60s, they weren't too interested in it at that time. And so I had to go to a lot of sources that I later on found out that were quite spiritual in many ways, but historically were inaccurate. I loved the work of Manly Palmer Hall and Theodore Helleen and Paul Foster Case and Emmett Fox and scores of others, because they were the only sources of information I had back there in the mid-60s that talked about this pyramid, the eye in the triangle. And they discussed this symbolism along the lines of there being 50 of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence that were Freemasons. And then they said things like that the guys that designed the Great Seal of the United States were basically Freemasons, being Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams, etc. And when I put all this together, it sounded like I finally got a handle on what was going on. And then it wasn't until my doctoral thesis, which took me about 5.5 years of agony, going to primary sources, etc., that I began to realize that all the research I did towards that time period and the speculation that I did was not on firm ground at all. Now, that's kind of embarrassing, and it is embarrassing to talk about this from that standpoint, but as you know, if you have your doctorate, you know exactly how difficult it is to obtain one and why 90% of those people who start them never finish, especially those verbal exams, which are just that terrorize you. The sad part was some years later, I learned that there were not 50 of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence that were Freemasons or any secret societies, and that Jefferson, Franklin, and Adams, all the ideas that they had for the Great Seal were rejected, and none of their ideas were used. So I began to realize then that even though this information sounded good, looked good, when you got down to the bottom of it, the research wasn't strong enough. And then, of course, along comes the Internet, and there's such speculation on the Internet because it doesn't have peer review. And as you know, when you're doing research, peer review is important. It can get in the way of getting the truth out, but it certainly taxes you to make sure that you got your facts straight or you're going to be clobbered by somebody out there who's done similar research. And it was then that I began to understand that the Founding Fathers were deeply influenced by what other people have referred to as the Age of Enlightenment. And that Age of Enlightenment was a time period that had put a lot of stress upon classical learning, that is the Roman and Greek times and even Egyptian periods, in which there were democracies, well, republics. I wouldn't necessarily call them democracies, but there were at least republics in Greece and Rome, and the Founding Fathers knew that. And, of course, that was one of the reasons why most of the buildings are neoclassical in Washington, D.C. They drew upon this information, basically, that when you get to a symbol like the eye or the eye in the triangle, it goes back thousands of years, not just with any particular secret society, but throughout classical literature. And it was in that area there that I began to understand just how profound the Founding Fathers were, and that they were very close to the Native Americans, which I did not understand until about 1989. That is the League of the Iroquois Indians. And boy, was I surprised in 1990 when the first President Bush came out with a statement which said basically this, that the League of the Iroquois Indians were indeed influential in helping the Founding Fathers develop a constitution, and that some of our constitution was based upon their constitution, and they founded that constitution anywhere between 1100 A.D. and 1400 A.D., somewhere in that particular area. So that's before Christopher Columbus got here. It's before, well, most historians have totally ignored this particular area, but it was that Biga Iroquois that actually came into, was invited into the Congress, and they discussed how they established their republic, and that made one big difference to Franklin, Jefferson, Washington, and of course John Adams was really excited about their particular work. So from that standpoint, the American symbolism goes a lot further back and is much more profound than just the possibility that some secret societies were involved. Now, there's no doubt that some of the founding fathers were Freemasons. Nine of them were. But that's a far cry from 50. It's a lot of individuals, but when you talk about 50, you're talking about the vast majority. And I dearly regret my making that error in quoting Manly Palmer Hall and others, because during that time period of the 60s, late 60s, I was going to be doing record album covers for Elektra Record, and so my job was just to meet various rockers that particular
time. What year was that?
In Elektra Records in New York City.
Yeah.
And one of the individuals that I enjoyed spending a little time with was Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix was a great musician. That's pretty new. I didn't know him. I knew James Brown because I worked in the record industry too.
Wow.
That's really funny. You were a generation before James Brown, even, you know. That's really cool. Jimi Hendrix.
Well, Jimi Hendrix was, as you know, was just brilliant in many different ways. But most people didn't realize that he was extremely bright. He not only was one of the greatest guitarists on the planet, but his insights into things were very, very deep. You know, he had a deep interest in UFOs. He had a deep interest in the paranormal, but mostly what he and I talked about, besides those things, was this pyramid in the eye and the triangle, because we both looked at it and said, this is really out there. There is something going on here that we really want to know about. And, of course, I passed on to him at that time all of the research that I had done, and it was riddled with errors. I hate to say that, Dr. Fred, but it was riddled with errors, because I did accept what Manly Palmer Hall and others did say, it wasn't until my recent conversation and interview with his sister, Janie Hendrix, she put out a book that was extraordinary, and in this book were his actual childhood drawings, and then the drawings he did in 1968 and 69, and bingo, when you get a hold of some of the copies of the drawings he did, he actually did pyramid and eyes in the triangle in the area of somewhere around late 1968 and early 1969. Well, we spent most of our time together in the summer of 1968. So I began to realize that he did take that information very seriously. You know, he was always drawing. He was an artist in many different ways. So I was really very happy to finally get corroboration on that particular idea, because every time I have related that information to other friends that I knew at that time, like the Lovin' Spoonful, or even more recently Ziggy Marley and the children of the Marley family, and certainly Bob Marley had an interest in this particular area. Most individuals would say, you know, I never saw that. I never saw Jimmy ever, or talked to him, ever discussed this particular area. So there was no way for me to prove that until just 2 years ago, actually a year and a half ago. And it's amazing to see Jimi Hendrix writing Hebrew and at the same time drawing Egyptian pyramids and eyes in the triangle and the Great Seal of the United States during that time period. It was to me, quite a thrill to see that all of the discussions that we had some depth, in the sense that he worked on them even after I decided that it was impossible for me to spend my time backstage talking with rockers, especially some of the ones I mostly enjoyed were not the most famous ones. The groups called Earth Opera, I don't know if you've ever heard of Earth Opera, or Peter Rowan, Tim Buckley.
I heard of Tim Buckley.
Oh, he was just extraordinary. all of these guys were basically, their interests were much deeper than the media ever told us. But at the same time, they were, their lives were nothing like we ever thought they were. I mean, Jimmy would walk around with very little money in his pocket. The same, you know the same story about John Lennon.
Yeah.
It was their managers and their handlers that really got hold of that money. And it's one of the reasons why many of the battles between rock bands and managers took place, like the ones with the Rolling Stones. I'm trying to think of his name right now, the guy that's Brian Jones. Brian Jones, who supposedly drowned in 2 feet of water in his own swimming pool. That was always questionable as to how he could have done that, since he was...
Like Jim Morrison in the bathtub, you know?
Correct, yes. But fortunately, with Brian Jones, I think it was 1986, or was it 1996, one of the three people that murdered him confessed on his deathbed as to how they did it and why they did it. The reason why they did it was because Brian had discovered that millions of dollars was missing, you know, the same situation that George Harrison and others have gone through.
Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson,
know, yeah.
Yes. There's another extraordinary mega. I mean, he is iconic from the standpoint. I have high regard for him. I'm happy that he wrote a piece on my book, and I spent a very little bit of time with him on his bus talking about these symbols and these kind of things, because here's a man that my own art car. I have a biodiesel art car, and obviously I believe that biodiesel is a stepping stone into making our country energy free from that standpoint.
That was our biggest product, hemp oil with lamps back at the turn of the century, you know.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
And Rudolph Diesel had designed. My dad worked for Henry Ford Sr., and Henry Ford Sr. hated the petroleum industry. He was good friends with Rudolph Diesel, and Henry Ford had hemp 18 acres of hemp trees on his property, and he had 12 automobiles that he ran strictly on biodiesel hemp fuel. My dad was there. I mean, I was delivered in 43 at Ann Arbor, Michigan Hospital by Norman Miller, his chief physician.
Boy,
the
what
Ford
interesting,
family was very close to our family, the original.
What interesting
original
karma you must have there, because, you know, there was a time when diesel was going to be the basic fuel or anything like that. As you know, Henry Ford's whole entire car was basically built out of hemp.
Yeah.
And run on hemp.
Yeah.
And it's a tragedy, a major tragedy, that our government looks at hemp and says, hey, this is marijuana. As you well know, the THC count of marijuana.
You know, the ship rigging, you know, on the old ships?
Yes,
sir. They were hemp ropes. Those hemp ropes will last 50 years.
Yes.
They go bad, like normal, you know, nylon ropes degrade and cotton ropes go bad, and those hemp ropes didn't, you know, on the rigging.
Of course, I'm sure you've seen the film that the government produced on that they absolutely denied making until I think it was in the 50s and 60s when it was rediscovered and brought out again. The Hemp for Victory, it was called.
Wow, I didn't see that.
And basically,
yeah,
what they were trying to do was get the farmers to grow as much hemp as possible, especially in regards to the war, the war effort at that time. And it's just amazing. Well, I shouldn't say it's amazing, but it is peculiar that it would take their absolute refusal that the government said they never did such a thing, and it was all made up and all this other kind of stuff. And then finally it being discovered. And of course they just said, well, that was all a mistake. So it's unfortunate, and that's one of the reasons why I believe that you and myself have gotten involved in the media. Because when you take a look at the media, with the media like the General Electric owning NBC, which came about in about 1986 because President Reagan opened that door, then the rest of corporate structures, such as Westinghouse owning CNN and another Walt Disney owning another network, etc., it's no wonder we just got entertainment and things that and are pointed in the direction of being just consumers rather than anything else, because the media...
Well, yeah, the news is pretty much entertainment. I mean, they're covering this missing girl, and, you know, that's this little girl that came up missing, and her mother, of course, telling lies, and that's a big thing in the news. And then I find out today that Russia had just moved in militarily into Georgia, one of their territories. That's not on the news. They're worried about some, it's important to find this child, but I mean, this is, it's like a war going on. We don't even know about it. I mean, the news is terrible. When I spend time in Europe, you get the real news, but
that's
you don't
right.
get it here.
That's right, and it is shocking, especially when you spend a little time. Every time we have a chance to get over into London to spend time with Sir George Martin, who is the individual that basically did most of the produced most of the Beatles' work, but also not just the Rolling Stones, but just anyone, and George Martin has produced them. They are so much more understanding of what America is what we look like to the rest of the world, and it's more than embarrassing. We are considered like children.
People behave like that. The emotional level of people here is very low because they're strung out on alcohol and these prescription drugs.
Boy, Fred,
other person that I know around this town where I live is on some kind of a Xanax or some
that's
kind of
right.
a drug. I mean, it's amazing.
And I don't think that's accidental. I really don't. I think that
it's programmed.
The power of the pharmaceutical companies is just almost as powerful as the. As petroleum companies, literally, they basically, it appears to me, have a great deal to say about anything and everything that goes on in this country. And I'm so glad that you're focusing on that area because, again, most of the media is just not considering these particular areas. Why do we push alcohol in this country so much? Why do we push other drugs? Everything except. And I hope I don't disturb your listeners or yourself in this. But
you won't bother my listeners. They've heard everything on this show.
Well, then why? Then you know the value of marijuana.
Yeah.
You know the value in its health, what it does. When you take a look at something like, you take a look at Woodstock, of which there are at least 350,000 people together, that can actually get along together. I painted a bus that went up to Woodstock, and I didn't want to go. I still have my tickets, but I didn't want to go because
you're still probably kicking yourself for not going too.
No, I'm glad I didn't because
Harry got pretty muddy up there when it rained.
Yeah, I heard my friends say that there were going to be 50,000 people up there.
Yeah,
and I said, forget it, 50,000 people. I'd much rather wait till Jimmy and everyone else comes back to New York and spend time with them. But you're right, that weather was unbelievable. But look what happened at that particular. Experience, there was a tiny bit of violence, but if that had been an alcohol experience, you know what would have happened.
Oh, yeah.
There's a big difference. Our country does push alcohol, and that can be quite deadly, needless to say, in all kinds of other ways. But unfortunately, that's I think the reason, please correct me if you think I'm wrong here, I think the reason why our government is so supportive of alcohol is that it allows you to control people pretty well.
Exactly. That's exactly what it does. I think to get a reading on the DUI business, they're really cracking down on that in all the states now. Even in Europe, I find out they're DUI conscious over there. So they start getting these people with one and two offenses, they start incarcerating them, they start scaring them, and they take them to these classes, and they start programming them. So there's a lot of programming going on in the alcohol business, and it's funny. You're in a society where you can't drink and drive, but there's a liquor store on every corner.
Yeah. Well, I think I would much rather have us drunk and taking pills than just about anything else. Because
out here, where are you at anyway? What state are you in?
We're in Maryland.
Yeah. Okay. We're out here in California, and the big thing out here in California now is that. They issue these medical marijuana certificates to everybody, and they smoke pot. But the feds don't like that. Feds come in here because people start smoking pot, and they don't get DUIs anymore, and they get relaxed. They don't cause problems. There's no fights or violence. And you should see how they used to chase, especially in Laguna Beach, they used to chase the little centers that sell the stuff, the dispensaries, I guess you call them, that are legal by the state of California. The government, the feds come in here and try to mess with them all the time.
Yeah.
So finally, I guess California has put up such a big fight, Because I find that when people go on marijuana, they don't drink alcohol anymore, or way down.
That's
all the alcoholics, it's the transfer of substance abuse, but still, it has a lot less impact on the negative, you know, confrontation with society. You know,
well, no
that's
doubt.
What I've seen anyway.
I think also the other area is what there's been in the past, and now more research, just beginning at Johns Hopkins here again, on psychedelics and the near-death experiences. And higher consciousness, and I think this is the key, Fred. I think the key is that when you use certain types of drugs, you get into higher consciousness. And when you get into higher consciousness, your ideas become much more creative. But most importantly, you begin to see energy fields. You begin to see other things that you do not see under normal circumstances, and I don't believe that our government is interested at all in us becoming more psychic.
That defeats their creeping fascist policy.
That's correct.
Know?
I mean, you know, in the future, when we all are far more advanced in that area, you'll be able to look at a person and be able to determine whether they're telling you the truth or not. Now, I don't think our politicians want that to happen.
No, and
I don't think
every one of them would be in trouble.
I know. So I think they look at certain types of drugs as being mind-expanding in the real sense of the word and are fearful of them and will try to keep them under lock and key because it's a control method from that standpoint. But I think any creative person knows that when you spend a long time working on anything, that there's another method by which to elevate consciousness that without the use of any drugs, and that deals with any type of creativity. Creativity just releases certain types of hormones and energies within the body so that you move towards higher consciousness and you move towards becoming more and more possessive of using your psychic abilities and that type of thing. And I think that's also one of the reasons why the arts today are extremely important, because it's one of the few areas that our government yet can control. We still have freedom of being able to do our political cartoons, which can be extremely educative and humorous at the same time, especially under this particular administration.
Yeah, I like the one where they depicted the Sheikh with a turban on, with a bomb. That one went over pretty good.
Yeah,
I forget who did that, but I remember that created quite a stir. Remember that one about a year ago?
Sure, yeah.
It was funny. The people take this stuff so literal. You get a kick out of this. I started my company, Pyridine, back in 75, and I my idea was I'm going to make pyramids that you wear on your head.
Sure.
Which I did. I'm the largest pyramid manufacturer in the world now. And what happened was I decided that if the symbolism is true on the dollar bill, and there's the third eye and there's the pyramid,
mm-hmm.
If I'm in the pyramid business, then every single dollar bill ever printed with a pyramid on it by right has to come through my hand. So I guess as long as they print $1 bills with a pyramid on them, I'll get to see them.
Well, I would hope that we continue to use that particular symbol. Because,
yeah, I think it's very important.
Oh, I agree with you. Because
yeah,
what it is...
There's a G-force to it, too.
There's been a lot of misunderstandings about that particular symbol. And when you take a look at the two guys that really designed it and completed it in 1782, and that was Charles Thompson, who was Secretary of Congress for 15 years.
Right.
And he was also... highly regarded by the Native Americans. They actually gave him the name of Man Who Tells the Truth.
Wow.
For a Native American to give a name like that to a Caucasian at that particular time...
Yeah, that's brilliant.
That is an extraordinary event. That's how highly
he
was regarded.
That's like a Nobel Prize from the Indians.
You're right. You're right, Fred. Charles Thompson and this other fellow, William Barton was a heraldist, and also he created and designed some of our paper money and that type of thing. And these are the two guys that put it together. And what did they say about that eye in the triangle? Very simple. They said, that is the eye of providence. That is the supreme being overlooking the founding of this nation. That this nation is a rebirth of the age of enlightenment, in which we would not only have the freedom of religion, but also beliefs of other in the areas that we have today. And this actually, of course, was a separation of church and state, which was most important to all the founders, especially Thomas Jefferson, who basically said, you know, when you have the coming together of church and state, then you easily have a monarchy. And God bless Thomas Jefferson, because back somewhere, it was around 1790s, in the 1790s, late 1798 to 1800 especially, the most important battle for the saving of our republic took place, because up in Boston at that particular time, there were a group of fundamentalists, and this group of fundamentalists basically were depending upon their research, saying that the founding fathers were not only involved in Freemasonry, but another esoteric group called the Illuminati.
Right.
And they used two particular sources, John Robison and Abbe Barrowell. And both of these sources have been proven to be not factual at all. A lot of speculation and a lot of BS, etc. But they basically thought the Federalist Party at that time, in 1798, thought that mankind, to form a new government, we could not rule ourselves, that we needed a king. And I'm sure most Americans have heard about the idea that George Washington refused to accept the kingship, but who? I've always wanted to hear this story in the past as to who was it that kept telling him, who kept supporting him. And it was religious fanatics up there in the northeastern part of our country. And they almost got away with it. And Jefferson actually did battle them verbally for a number of years, and finally he was elected president, and that changed the course of our country for about 20 years, and then, of course, with other presidents bringing their horses into the White House and riding around on them.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Jefferson had a really hard life.
Yes.
He didn't have a silver spoon life. He lost, I don't know how many, what, three or four of his kids?
Yes, he did.
His oldest daughter is about the only one surviving. I think he even lost his wife at one point.
Yes,
they all died
wife.
Of these different plagues and diseases and
yeah.
You know, things that came around. That's got to be pretty hard on somebody losing their family like that, you know.
And then of course, he lost literally Monticello. He died very poor. This was one of our greatest of all the founding fathers, and he's being condemned, by the way, today by many fundamentalists, conspiratorialists, because they think of him as satanic. They're anger of his involvement with Sally Hemings, an African-American slave at that particular time. And he and Sally, most of these people don't realize that Jefferson's wife made him promise that when he passed, she passed on. Not to marry again.
Yeah.
That is an awfully difficult thing to do for a genius. Jefferson really did fall in love with Sally Hemings. They did have children.
Yeah.
And he is very much condemned by the fundamentalists today. As a matter of fact, one of the murals that I did, the third mural I did for Johns Hopkins University Safe and Smart Center at that time in 1996, I wanted to put Thomas Jefferson in it. And they wouldn't allow me.
Wow. I didn't know. You do paintings?
Yes, I've done a number of murals. As a matter of fact, I went up to your great website. You've got a great website.
Oh, thanks.
And you have a couple of a photograph of one of the last murals I just completed that has Bob Marley and Bob Dylan, as well as Harriet Tubman and Lou Gong, who was one of the Tiananmen Square fellows who faced down the communists.
Yeah, speaking of Tiananmen Square, the Olympics started today.
Yeah. that was extraordinary. You know, and they loved, as we, most Americans should know, that the reason why they came down so hard and rode their tanks right over many of these guys was because they wheeled out I think it was a 20-foot tall, maybe 16-foot tall Statue of Liberty. Very similar to ours, not totally the same, but it meant it was a symbol of the Statue of Liberty, and that is what incited the Chinese at that time to eliminate them as soon as possible, because they could see allegedly where that went. And that's one of the reasons why we put Lou Gong, who we met and came to the opening of the mural, And he was incarcerated for years, beaten to a pulp, and fortunately, after 5 years of it, got out. And no help from us in the United States. Bush at that time was certainly not interested in defending those particular. He said a lot of nice words, but we wouldn't defend them. He didn't.
Yeah, he talks nice sometimes, and then he talks stupid sometimes. But when he does stupid talking, he actually acts that out, though. But the nice stuff and the brilliant stuff, nothing ever happens. I agree.
Well, it was very unfortunate because it allowed the Chinese to think that, well, it's okay. We can continue to destroy these people, and we're not really.
Just think, if Reagan had been in when this happened, it'd have been a whole other scenario.
You got that right.
Yeah,
you got that right. He would not. He would have definitely come up against them
with brilliance and class, and they probably would have listened to him and got something from it.
I agree.
Yeah,
Fred, that's right. I mean, you know, it's just Reagan was considerably different than Bush, especially along those lines.
Yeah, Reagan was the last of the great presidents, and it's so funny that the Republicans always compare themselves to him when they're being stupid. What part of Reagan don't they get? Any of it?
I don't know, but I fortunately had the privilege of going to his inauguration.
Wow.
And with my mother-in-law, who actually was she was a representative from the United Nations. She was one of the secretaries there.
Wow.
And that is how I had the great fortune of spending a little bit of time with Anwar el-Sadat, when we established a sister city relationship between Baltimore and Luxor, Egypt, and Alexandria, Egypt, which is still certainly functioning now. But Anwar el-Sadat, the time that we spent some time together, was in Georgetown University, when he came. The first thing I did is I was carrying a gold coin in my hand that had the front side of the Great Seal and the back side of the Great Seal on it, the only one I had, and I gave it to him.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you give it to him?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
I did. I gave it to him with the pyramid front side up, and he stopped everything. The whole line stopped at that particular time because he was focused on this. I was a little bit fearful of putting my hands in my pockets with all the guards around and everything like that, but there was no problem with that. He looked at the pyramid and he said, you know, this is a meditative symbol. This pyramid is Egypt. And then he turned it over to the front side and he pointed to the cloud above the eagle's head. And he said, you see this? This is Israel. And there were six pointed, there was a 13 five-pointed stars and a six-pointed star pattern, which is still on the front side of the Great Seal today. And
wow.
He said, this is a prophecy. He said, the prophecy is that Egypt and Israel would come together to lay the foundation for peace in the Middle East.
Yeah, he was brilliant. He was the most peaceful, you know, Middle Eastern person at the time, and I don't think anybody's come along. He was like the Reagan of the Middle East, I thought.
Well, he was great, but unfortunately he was hated by most of the Egyptians.
Yeah.
Which I did not know. You know, I did not know all the time.
I didn't know that either. I thought they loved him. I know.
So did I. So did I. I mean, you know, and of course, that his murder,
yeah,
his assassination, is at the hands of not outsiders and that type of thing. And of course, it changed the changed Egypt tremendously in some ways, because when we had to go back and take more photographs of the tombs and that type of thing, all of the privileges that we had under Sadat were taken away. When I mean privileges like one time that my wife and I went there, they took us to the Tutankhamun tomb, and they let us stay in the tomb for hours by ourselves.
Wow.
By ourselves, Fred.
No, I can relate.
No, I mean, that's just not done.
No.
I
know Sally's a friend of mine. I met him when he was really young. He's the curator now. But he'll let a few people hang out in the pyramids, but not in King Tutankhamun's tomb. That's
all changed.
That's some expensive property there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I had a real interesting experience though at the Tower Castle in London. You know where all the jewels are?
Yeah.
I was at the end of the day. I was with it. I was doing a seminar near Kensington Palace, actually, and we were Mia and myself and a few of my crew from my company were down there looking at all of the jewels. You know, you kind of watch kind of a big round semicircle with about a foot thick of glass, and all the jewels, the scepters, and all that stuff are in there. You know, and so. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, and I got my nuclear receptor on, which has pyramids on it, and so the guards were watching me. I was like really looking at the emeralds and stuff, and so when I went around like to exit the display underground, it's all underground. The guard pulled me aside. He says, "Come over here," and I says, "Yeah, okay." And I didn't know what he wanted. And he says, "Look, we're closing in 10 minutes. You want to learn about this stuff?" He says, "I think you really appreciate this." So. They closed it out 10 minutes, and one of the older guards took me over there and explained the magic of the jewels and the scepters and how they use them in royal ceremonies for thousands of years.
That's extraordinary.
You know what I mean? And it's just like in the amulets, it's like blew me away. He spent an hour with me. I got to spend an hour with the crown jewels of England, you know, and it was awesome.
Well. And yeah. Where are they? Beautiful. Oh.
Energy is tremendous.
That's right, yeah.
You probably know about that, huh?
Well, those kind of, as you know, gemstones have healing powers.
Yeah.
Especially turquoise, that I think, which is perhaps one of the most affordable of the gemstones, which I always wear. Mainly
the Indians love that stuff. The Indians use so much of that.
Yes, they did. And you know, they value it above gold.
Yeah, I can see why.
Because of the healing potential, and that, in the sense that some of the teachings are basically that... What turquoise can do is if you wear it and people are sending you negative energy, you don't have to do anything to defend yourself. The
right.
Stone takes the energy and sends it back to them, and it becomes their own karma. Now, that is a spiritual technology that I think we can all use.
I totally agree. I like that. What about lapis? Because the Egyptians are big with lapis.
Lapis lazuli is just incredible. It's a stone that's very good for mental, clear thinking. Do you have a good lapis?
Yeah, I have lapis.
Oh, good. I was just wondering if you didn't. I'd certainly love to send you one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I want to send you one of my books and some other stuff. I'll get your address after the show through your agent and everything, and we'll swap stuff out.
Oh, that would be great. And of course, I want to go back to my book, United Symbolism of America, because...
tell us about your book a little bit.
Well, the reason
14 minutes left. I want to, you know,
we're having such a good time, Fred.
I know, we're having fun here.
I know.
I feel like I'm at a brother here.
Yeah,
you know?
We are, obviously. There's a lot of karma.
Yeah, you're on the same page as I am.
You know, the United Symbolism of America, basically, when we finished it, it came to almost 700 pages. But... unfortunately, no publisher is going to do 700 pages, and that's the reason why we created the website UnitedSymbolismOfAmerica.com. You go up there, and you can see much of the information that can't be found in the book, as well as many more illustrations than we have. We have 70 illustrations in the book, and that's good, but we really wanted about 150, and obviously we just couldn't do it. So that's why we established that website. And
we'd like to probably sell that book on our website, if you don't mind.
Well, we'd love to do that.
We'd love to sell it.
But the most important thing about the United Symbolism of America is this. When after so many decades of studying American symbols, there's something that I found that unites them all, and it has a lot to do with a certain type of philosophy, and that philosophy has to do with balance. That is... balance between the spiritual world and the material world, because it's my bias now that I believe that our nation, as well as the rest of the planet in many ways, has they have been so deeply involved with thinking that the physical world is all there is, and so therefore the most important thing for people to do is to have things, to consume as much as possible, physical things. Our founding fathers, when they utilized that symbol, the pyramid and the eye in the triangle, what they were saying basically is the eye in the triangle being spirit, the pyramid and that being the providence of the supreme deity, that is the spiritual dimension, and the pyramid being the physical dimension, and they used the pyramid, as William Barton said, for strength and duration, because they felt that there was nothing that's been more physically long existing that man has created as the Great Pyramid. So that's the reason why they chose that. But what you have there is this pyramid is a symbol for the physical material world. The eye and the triangle is the spiritual dimension. And that, I believe, is what human beings are all about. I don't believe human beings are just physical bodies. I think we have an immortal component. You can call it spirit, you can call it soul, but it is the part of the divine flame, part of the divine energy, and it's making contact with that divine energy within us that really helps us evolve from the standpoint of understanding who we are and why we're here and what we're supposed to be doing to fulfill that purpose. Now, the
I totally agree with you, and it's unfortunate that in the last, five decades, we started to lose track of that. We took In God We Trust out. We took the Pledge of Allegiance of the flag. You know, we modified that. You know, I don't really personally care if people believe in God or not, but if they believe in a higher authority and they're somehow affiliated with it, I think it makes us a better person.
No doubt about it.
Because I know every time I try to do something on my own, I screw it up. But if I surrender, if I get up in the morning and want to do 10 things that I think need to be done, and I get 3 done and 7 not finished, it's only because the spirit of the day led me somewhere else and I had no choice,
mm-hmm.
and that was what I was supposed to do. And I say, well, I got 3 things done. That's the total success. That's kind of how I've lived my life for a number of years. I tried to do it my way, and it never worked. I don't know how Sinatra got away with that, you know. Just don't get that.
He got away with it because he had a lot of bodyguards. I had a good friend.
And a lot of money.
Yeah, I had a good friend who was one of the Four Seasons, and they used to have to be the group that sang before Frank Sinatra, and the stories I heard were legion. They were extraordinary. But back to the American symbolism, that eye in the triangle, the pyramid, is about balance. Really, it's spirit and matter. When you look at the front side, you have the eagle carrying the arrows that it in its left talon and its right talon. It's carrying the olive branch. Its head is facing towards the olive branch. And again, it's this balance between the peace and being able to defend yourself. When you get to the flag, it's very interesting because, you know, our American flag at one time did not have, there were basically no laws outlining the kind of stripes it would have. And we indeed one time had red, white, and blue stripes.
Right. I didn't know that.
Isn't
I thought
that
we had red and
flag?
White stripes.
The red, white, and blue stripes, I'm looking at one right now, it had 8 pointed stars instead of 6 or 5 or 7 pointed stars.
Now, wait, was that before Betsy Ross did our flag or what?
Yes, yeah. Yes, but it wasn't Betsy Ross that did our flag. It was Francis Hopkinson, again, the signer of the Declaration of Independence, signer of the Constitution, a representative from New Jersey who also designed the naval seals and that type of thing. But Francis Hopkinson actually is the guy that really designed our American flag.
Yeah, it's nice to get history right from people that know it.
Well,
but you read in classroom school books is usually not junk.
Well, the reason why that is because it was one of it wasn't until about 1890s until that's when one of Betsy Ross's relatives came out and made the statement that she was involved in designing the flag. And most historians didn't pay much attention to it until about 1912 when they did some historical checking and they found out that Betsy Ross didn't meet with George Washington to actually create the flag, but she worked on his cuffs and she worked on some of his clothes, and she did make some American flags. There's no doubt about that, but she didn't design it at that time, but our first flags actually were based on red and white stripes, literally. And it's the red, of course, is a symbol for the male Martian type energy, the blood, genetics, and that type of thing. The white stripe is the feminine intuition related to the moon or the lunar aspect of it. And again, you have this balance between activity and passivity, or activity and intuition, outer and inner. It is that balance that's represented by those two colors. And at the same time, and if you get into heraldry, these are interpretations in heraldry. There's a science to heraldry from that standpoint. When you get to the Statue of Liberty, the balance comes into focus in which she is holding a torch in her right hand, the active force, the active hand, the Martian force, the maleness. In her left hand, she's holding keystone, or some refer to it as a book, that says July 4th, 1776, the founding of our republic, the beginning of our republic. And that Statue of Liberty, again, is a representative, and there are many other levels of meaning here, with that crown of 7 points, et cetera. You know, that's the highest chakra within the crown, meaning
wisdom. Right, crown chakra, right.
Yeah, she's right on there on the crown chakra, and a halo, like you would see around any other advanced soul or being. But again, it's about balance. It's representing the spiritual and the physical world. Even when you get to the Liberty Bell, you have the same kind of balance, in the sense that the actual dome, or the actual shell of the bell, is the feminine uterus symbol, and the clapper that makes all the noise is the more masculine Martian activity. And so, again, when you have a bell without the clapper, it can't make any noise. But without the dome, then it has nothing to knock up against, so it still can't make any noise. So it's this balance between the positive and the negative, the peace and activity, that type of balance, which I think is what our founding fathers basically were talking about. We need to keep ourselves in balance. And we do this, you know, there are ways of doing it, but a simple way that's always been attractive to me is the process of three different things. One, prayer, the talking to the divine being within ourselves, and the guidance that we need from that particular energy. That prayer is extremely important. Then meditation is listening to the divine, and be still and know that I am God. You know, there are various phrases in the Bible that refer to going inside and meditating oneself. But after one does both of these processes, the prayer and meditation, the third and most important in some ways is being able to take that energy and serve others, to help others. And I think as we have moved now towards the time period when there are going to be some mega earth changes in the United States and the rest of the planet, changes in not just global warming, but all kinds of problems we're going to have in regards to the kind of earthquakes that we will have, the kind of tsunamis that are being spread, and the problems that we're beginning to have with things like Katrina. And Katrina will be a pretty small problem in comparison to some of the storms, mega storms, that we may be experiencing.
Yeah, Steve Barish, my co-host, he's on some of these shows. We're doing a big thing on Planet X right now, which seems to rotate around us about every 3,600 years, and it's coming in, and it'll be here in 2012.
Yeah.
So, and it's a brown dwarf, supposedly an unignited star about the size of Jupiter. So we're looking at, last time it was here, Moses was parting the Red Sea. So we're thinking that the presence of this alien, you know, planetary long elliptical body coming through will bring up the sensitivity to psychic activity. You know, mm-hmm. back in the King Arthur's time, if you crossed the Avalon Lake in one consciousness, you'd end up at a Benedictine monastery, or if you cross the same lake under a different head spin, you know, you'd end up in a white witch camp. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we used to call that splitting the ethers, and I think we're coming back into that. And I think that if you're on a higher path, like we've been talking about tonight, I think you'll be able to walk into that higher realm of activity and be in a much more comfortable place. Whereas if you're one of these poor, unfortunate souls that's strung out on prescription drugs and not doing too well and not telling the truth and eating bad foods and putting bad things in your body, I don't think they're going to make it through here. And judging by the amount of fast foods and the advertisements and the commercials and what I see in this country, there ain't going to be much of it left in 4 or 5 years. People aren't going to be here anymore.
I think you're absolutely right, and I applaud you for doing that, because most Americans are not going to be able to adjust quickly to the kind of changes that we will be experiencing. And the rest of the planet's going to be going through it too, but that doesn't make it much easier for you and your family and other children and that kind of thing. And I think that the more that people are prepared in the sense that turning within, seeking their guidance within themselves, and then helping and assisting others, because
that's the only way I feel that you can... you can go within and stay there in a comfortable place is help others go within and help do healing. If you no man's an island. I think when you isolate yourself, and I've tried it, it doesn't work for me. For 10 years before I had this radio show, I quit doing trade shows and lecturing and speaking. I just went recluse for 10 years, and I had to come back, and I just embraced myself and humanity again because it got a little lonely out there. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I know just what you mean.
I wasn't scared. I was just lost in my own whatever, you know?
Well, you know, Joseph Campbell and his works dealing with the hero's journey, what you've just said is an example as to what those who go on this journey, such as yourself, must pass through, and that is that coming up against a problem, breaking away from traditional means of trying to work things out to find out who you are and why you are here, and then after you successfully go through that particular initiation, you return, as Joseph Campbell says, and you take the treasure that you have found symbolically within yourself, and you take that treasure and you give it to others.
Exactly.
You share it with others, and you assist others on this path, because we're all basically on the same path. And that was some of the why I believe when I started studying American symbols from the standpoint of their balance and the united symbolism of America, and that's the reason why we wanted to get this book out before this next election, especially in regards to the fact that we are, basically, this nation is could lose a great deal in the future if it doesn't start to balance itself out. The spiritual world is in dimension is extremely important. And if folks, if you can't find the book at Barnes & Noble, which it is, go to Amazon.com because it's almost half the price. It's about the best deal you can...
That's your book?
Yes.
Well, we're going to be having it on our website.
I hope you do. I hope you
do. Go ahead and you have a website, too. Go ahead and we're running down to the end of the show here. We only got about a minute and a half left. Why don't you have any phone numbers?
Yes. If you want to order the book by phone, you can call 1-800-227-3371. Again, it's in all Barnes & Nobles, but the best price, again, is on Amazon.com. It's about half the price that you would pay for it at Barnes & Noble. And I think that one of the things that we need to do is the same kind of experience that you, Fred, that you've already gone through, fortunately, and made it through the other side. It took you 10 years to do it. But when you do find out your purpose, it's time to give that treasure to others, to help others. We cannot depend on our government. The government has shown us just how foolish they can be in regards to Katrina. That should have been resolved.
Yeah, government, unfortunately... You have to intimidate. In the old days, like in France, they have their best medical program. The French will intimidate their government, and then the government performs. If you don't intimidate the government will intimidate you, and you won't perform, and they will. And that's what's happened in this country. People have taxed themselves. They've pushed their credit cards. They've lived beyond their means. They've decimated their children by not paying attention to them because they're always trying to put bread on the table. If they've completely done it all wrong, and now they're going to have to, you know, pay the price. The dollar is being slaughtered, you know, by every other country. It's kind of sad.
It is, but it's also a time for us to stand up for the balance that we need in this country,
yeah,
and to share with others and assist others, especially the elderly, because they are going to be in a terrible situation, if they're not already.
But anyway, we're running out of time.
Oh, yes, we are. Fred, I want to thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed this hour.
I had a good time with you, by the way, today.
Well, I certainly had a great time with you. I'm so glad we were able to talk about many of the different areas that we share, especially in regards to elevating consciousness and what's coming in the future. It's not going to be a pretty picture, but we can indeed lay a new foundation for the continuation of our republic.
All right, well, we're out of town, Robert. I'll get a hold of you. We're running the last seconds here. I'm going to call you later, if you don't mind, tomorrow or probably Monday.
Okay.
And you've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. We're running over here. It's bbsradio.com, August 8, 2008. Our guest has been Dr. Robert Hieronymus, a sensational guest. Until next week, be good. Help someone.